I was asked to give this talk. I had to come up with a title, and before I could come up with a title, the title was just there. It was like somebody had put it under the door. And the title was The End of Silence, and I thought, oh God, why can't I choose an easy title? And I knew it would be difficult. I actually prepared a rather lovely talk. I didn't have all the details, but it had a very particular structure and architecture, and that was all taken away from me last week with a lot of other things in Chicago. So, we're just going to have to take this step by step. It's very hard to talk about the end of silence. Because what is silence to begin with? Maybe later on I'll be able to say something about silence, because I don't think we really understand very much about what silence is. But I'd just like to say to begin with, one of the first things that came to me when I looked at this title, The End of Silence, was it's not actually about the end of silence, it's about the end of its opposite, because if you look at it, words are incredibly precious. And although we can mean or imply different things when we're talking about one thing, we can actually only be saying one thing at a time. It's extraordinarily finite speech. It means if we speak about one thing, we are being silent about everything else, including silence, of course. Every time we have a choice, if we speak about something, we're actually choosing not to speak about everything else. And for me, the question is, well, for a long time, we in our own lives and the civilization for several thousand years has been talking, 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 yak, yak, yak. All the news and all the radio waves and all the frequencies are full of talk. And then, what is that talk actually covering? What is the silence underneath that talk? And I felt something from the depths. It's like the end of silence is, yes, something has to come out, but it actually has to come out by creating a new, different kind of silence so that something new can come out. And that has not been very easy for me to come to terms with. First of all, I'd like to be honest with you. I feel I'm accountable here. I'm sitting to give a talk. And I just think it's a part of my responsibility to be as honest as I can. A couple of days ago, after we arrived here, I was a part of a presenters meeting for this conference. And I was very happy to be there. It's very, very beautiful to be together with these wonderful people. And we talked for, I don't know, about an hour. And I began to feel stranger and stranger as the meeting was going on. And it was like I was aware that this was a presenter's meeting and I wasn't present. What I mean by that is I was present physically, I was present in my attention, but I was aware that there's something in me that wasn't present or isn't present. And it has to do with the fact that there are these other people there from this conference who represent traditions that are here, that are alive, that are present. And for some strange reason, I'm attached to or connected to a tradition that comes from way, way back in the past, primarily from 2,500 years ago. It's ancient tradition that actually gave rise to Western civilization in a very, very important way, and then was carried through, especially through Zulnun, head of the Sufis, into Sufism, also into Jewish mystical tradition. But the presence, certainly in the Western world, has gone. And I've seen, I don't want to get too esoteric about this, but I see things about this tradition through the months, through the years. And it's coming back, and it's coming back from far, far away. It actually left, it left this whole cosmos quite a long time ago. And now it's coming back for a very specific purpose that I get little glimpses of now and then. And it's actually parked, it's docked just beside the earth now. But the door isn't quite open for it to come in. I can do what I can do. I've been shown that I need help in a certain way. But it's just there and it's not there. It's almost present, but it's not yet present. And so after this meeting, I hadn't been well for a few days, but then I became very feverish and I had to go and lie down. Extremely feverish, I was burning up. And I lay down in my room. I wasn't able to come to the events, which was very, very strange. And Maria would actually come and tell me after someone had given a talk and actually summarize for me. She usually doesn't do this, but this time I asked her to, and she would actually summarize and say things from the talks. And it was so strange because in this space, this feverish space that I was in, lying in bed, those same, the words, expressions, sometimes it's like whole sentences, had actually been there with me. And it was like I was with this conference, but not. I was present, but I was somewhere else. And after I lay down on Friday night, I was told something very clearly. I went into meditation and I was told, if you want to get well, the way to get well is to go back to around when the world began. That is what I was told. And that's very easy because in this ancient Greek tradition, to go back to around, it wasn't very specific, you know, around a few million years here or there, doesn't really matter. Go back around that time is very easy. You just go deep down inside yourself. They would say you go down into the underworld. And there is the world of eternity. And I'd just like to say, I think that there are people here who are a little bit frightened of the underworld. And I love the shamanic attitude, which is, you know, basically, and this is the ancient Greek attitude as well, we're going to go there sooner or later, and it's better to go there now before we die. It really helps to do that. There's no getting away from it. But there's also something else about the underworld, and that is that we've become so focused on the light as a culture, as a civilization. We're grabbing at the light so much into the light in all the aspects of whatever light can be. And the darkness, she is so lonely. She's just crying out for some attention. Nobody visits her anymore. And the darkness, the great powers in the underworld, they need us. They don't want to be left out. They can't be left out. They long for us to go back and find this mystery of the light in the middle of the darkness, which hasn't been done for a long, long time. And another thing about the underworld is the richness of it. We're terrified of it, but the name Pluto, Pluto and Persephone, the king and queen of the underworld, Pluto means wealth in Greek, Plutos. The god of the underworld is the giver of wealth. But the trouble is that if we scorn that god, all hell breaks loose. I found it so interesting a few weeks ago, maybe you heard or saw it, that a group, I think it was the International Astronomers Association, they voted to demote Pluto from being a planet. And I actually read an interview with this bright spark from Caltech who was the main mover behind this vote. And it was beautiful. Apparently it was done when the main people from the conference, they'd actually left. It was like a Sunday. And, you know, Sunday lunch, most of them left, but there had to be a quorum to get this passed. And then the ones who wanted to get Pluto out, they stayed behind. And they said, well, there's no one else here, so we're going to do it. It wasn't even a full vote. And the guy behind this from Caltech, he was interviewed for the BBC, and he said, well, I guess I'll go down in history as the guy who killed off Pluto. And I remember I said to Maria that day, I read that to her, and I said, this is it. And I said, I have a feeling this, now Pluto is going to get his revenge. It'll probably be pretty quick, and I bet it'll come through plutonium. And the next day, Iran announced that it had opened, that it was about to open a plutonium processing plant outside of Tehran. Not a uranium processing plant, a plutonium processing. It's quite a different kettle of fish. I didn't realize it would be that quick. So I was in this state the last day or so, and about going back to around when the world began, I was actually shown, it's very, very beautiful, I was shown the shape of creation. It's like a figure eight below a figure eight below a figure eight below a figure eight. Like this. And it was pure light at the top. And it was light almost all the way down except for the bottom circle. And that was the circle both of my body, which was not well, is rather sick, and also of the world as things are now. And what I found so interesting in seeing this, because it was everything except for the bottom was this incredible white fire. So beautiful, so alive. What I saw was the bottom, where it faded out, it wasn't because of a lack of light. And that's something, it was very important for me because I'm used to later Greek philosophers, and I guess mystics as well, who talk about the deficiencies of matter and how matter is opposed to light. Not just how matter is dense, but how there is this negation in matter, how it somehow stands against the purity of spiritual light. And I saw it wasn't to do with that at all. It's not that matter is resisting light. It's not that there's a lack of light to get down there. I saw what is causing that lack of light down there is very simple. It's a lack of subtlety. It's not our bodies that are the problem. It's the lack of subtlety. And so there was like a clogging of the arteries down there. Just a lack of this subtlety to bend the light around. And of course, when the light goes down there, if it can just go down to the bottom, then it goes up and down and up and down. and now it's everywhere except for the bottom, so the whole process is stuck. There's plenty of light to go around, and our bodies, matter, they're not the problem, it's the lack of subtlety. And this tradition, this ancient Greek tradition, especially Empedocles, this man from 2,500 years ago, who I'm so connected with, this tradition is all about subtlety, and that's really what I'd like to try and talk about today in a very indirect way, I guess. I don't know how to talk directly about subtlety. So I think what I'm going to do is actually I'm going to begin by talking very unsubtly about something that happened to Maria and me last week. Because this is not abstract. This is not just kind of metaphysical something. And again, it's really for me to be honest because it knocked the bottom out of me what happened. But I think I should say it and then try and talk from there. About, it's basically a lack of subtlety in me, how something was really blocked up in me, and bam, needed the energy of Chicago to blast that out of me last week, and hopefully make me a little bit more subtle. What happened was, a few days ago, Maria and I arrived in Chicago. We were due to take a connecting flight out here. It was about 4 in the afternoon. And there'd been bad weather in the afternoon, so the flight was delayed. So it was initially delayed for 2 hours, then 2.5 hours, then 3 hours, and then finally we were given a definite boarding time. The plane had come in from Providence. It was there at last. We were given a boarding time of 8 o'clock in the evening. And we were really tired by then. Everybody was tired. And there was this strange emotion in the air. I was very, very conscious. I would walk around quite a bit. I was very struck because this was everywhere in the airport. Everything was backed up. And I looked around, and it was very interesting. I kept on seeing young women crying. It wasn't older women. Old women were very bossy and very, I could see there was this kind of edge of, it's all right. And the men were silent. But very many, it was interesting, young women, they just had tears in their eyes. And I actually happened to stand next to a woman who, at one point, trying to get information, because United wouldn't give you any details at all. And this woman was, she really had tears in her eyes because she'd rushed to the airport, her father in Cleveland was in hospital, and they called her that he had just a few hours to live. He wasn't going to survive the night. And she couldn't get there. She said, God, he's going to die before I get there. And anyway, at last, with all this tension, everything, we were standing up, we had our boarding passes in our hands to get on the flight at 8 o'clock. 5 to 8, bam, the whole sky was lit up with lightning. And there was the most incredible thunderstorm. And it didn't go away. It just stayed, and it stayed, and everything shut down. The whole of Chicago Airport just shut down. All of the crew outside, they fled. Maria's bag, when we eventually got it, everything was totally soaked because they just left the bags out on the tarmac. They wouldn't bring them in. You know, everybody just scuttled away like mice. And we were there, 8 o'clock, waiting for the storm to finish. And then every so often, the crew would say, okay, it's done now. And then the lightning would come again. And they were just about to board us again, and the lightning. And we were very, very tired, as well as everybody else. And there came a point when I realized that I had the right to ask for help for us. And I prayed. And I asked for something to happen. And I was actually shown the space where I could ask for that to happen. And it didn't happen. And I was totally devastated. And we just sat there and it went on. And then United started playing this other game of sending us from one terminal to another. And I don't know if you know O'Hare Airport, it's pretty big. So we would start, and they said the first one was, well, this plane is due to leave for Albany in 5 minutes. How long is it going to take us to get there? Half an hour, but you know, and we'd be kind of dragging our bags and dragging ourselves, and that wouldn't work. Then we had to go back, and all of this, and eventually, it was midnight, and now everything was going to be okay, and they were about to board us again, and then, this was like the third flight now. They cancelled the first two. And then they were just about to board us, and then they cancelled it. And it was very interesting, because then it was midnight. We, along with everybody else who was exhausted, we started walking down and to get out of the airport. And we were told there was nowhere to stay. You know, because everybody from Chicago Airport was trying to stay somewhere. And so we walked down the end of this concourse, and down at the end, where we came out, there was the Hilton Hotel. And Maria and I said, okay, you know, we don't care about cost, we just need to rest. So we went into the Hilton Hotel. There were all these queues. There was a queue for the Hilton Honors. You know, that's people who have the special pass or whatever it is, the special card. They weren't being allowed in. Nobody was being allowed in. No rooms. Psht, no. So we went out, we went across the road, tried to find other hotels' accommodation. Everything was full, everything. And everybody said, you're not going to find a room within 30 miles of here. And there were these queues of people out on the street. And everybody was in such a state. And frankly, it was very interesting because somewhat I knew I had to, it was important just to watch this, to witness it. This state, and I actually thought, good Lord, this is just a thunderstorm. Imagine if there was some kind of an attack. And there was so much, just from this little thing, so much pain. And there was nothing, just nothing. And Maria and I looked at each other. Oh, and then this crazy guy came up in a minibus, and he tried to hustle us in, and he was offering some room for an exorbitant amount. He was dressed in a top hat and this filthy coat. And, you know, Maria and I said, okay, there is nothing else. This is the opportunity. We'll just do it, to hell with it. He looked so dubious. He looked so suspicious. And we said, we'll just do it. And then we just got in the van, and somehow I just knew. Maria was looking at me, and I said, we've got to get out. He was a bad dude. He really was. And then we were out in the street, it was still raining, and there was nothing to do. And I knew exactly what to do. And I said, okay, this is what we do. We're going back into the Hilton. Now, what's the point? I just knew, we're going back into the Hilton. We went back into the Hilton, and there was the same row of people turning everybody away. Nothing had changed. It's probably just worse. Hopeless. In fact, even a couple of the guys who we'd spoken to before, they gave me a filthy look just even for coming through their door. And at that moment, just as soon as we came in, a side door behind the counter, behind the desk opened, and a woman came out. And I went straight up to her, and then it was very strange. I just talked to her, and there was nothing personal in it. And Maria, she said afterwards, she was aware of a very particular way that I talked. It wasn't pitiful or anything. It certainly wasn't persuasive. It certainly wasn't pushing or anything. But I just said, give us a room, please. Anything you have. And she said, okay. And she went out the back and she found us this room. And she even said, look, you know, see the situation. You know, usually it costs so-and-so. You know, I'll give you a special price for it, considering the circumstances. And that was it. I mean, that's really the end of this story. Why I'm saying it is because Maria saw what happened as the answer to our prayers. And I knew that I'd used a particular quality of awareness to get that room. I knew what to do. I knew where to go. I knew to go back to the Hilton. I knew as soon as that woman came out, she was the woman to speak to. And there's a name for this quality of attention in ancient Greek, and that's metis. And the first thing about metis is, okay, metis means attentiveness, awareness, acute awareness of what's going around you, the ability to navigate through difficult situations and find a way through. It's also cunning, trickery, deceptiveness, but resourcefulness in general. And for the Greeks, metis was divine. She was a goddess. But she is also a goddess who is a part of humans. We can have access to that divine quality as humans. And what really staggered me as we eventually went up to the room was that every conception, every illusion, every idea I had of the divine as something separate from myself had gone. Somewhere I had been abandoned by Empedocles when I asked for help. There was no one out there. I knew there was no one out there. I can't describe how I knew, but I knew. And then suddenly later, I realized that it was coming through this quality of metis inside. Again, it's this subtlety where I was seeing how I had got so stuck in projecting things outside me, so stuck in actually creating out of the subtlety that this tradition is, a certain pattern of expectations. And then just to see how the divine can come through from outside, but it can also come through from inside. And that's to do with this certain quality of living oneness that actually just totally defies me. Because it's not just about subtlety, it's about responsibility. You know, I had to say, first of all, let's get out of the van. And what was very important there, what I saw was, you see, metis, I don't want to jump the gun here, but I need to talk about this slowly. Metis is not about compromise. I had to say no. We had to say no to this guy in the van. And then it was a matter of just facing the absolutely impossible situation and finding an impossible way out of the impossible. Now, metis is crucial to this tradition. As I said, it means cunning, trickery, resourcefulness, alertness, deceptiveness, ability to deal with the deceptiveness of creation. And it was a quality used by pilots of ships, was used by fishermen, was used by all sorts of people. It was used by thieves, it was used by gamblers, and it was also used in this tradition as a way to God. And what's so important here is that metis is in the essence, in the fabric of creation. This whole world is deceptive. And what these people, what Empedocles in particular said is, this is a deceptive universe, so we have to be deceptive ourselves. Just to be innocent as a dove is not enough. We have to be cunning as serpents too. And this takes me back to the man originally who introduced me to this whole theme of metis was my professor, my supervisor at Cambridge over 30 years ago. And as I was writing my thesis at Cambridge, he, very rightly, you know, from a practical point of view, he kept on telling me, Peter, you must use metis to get a job at Cambridge University. You have to use strategy, cunning, tactics. You have to know how to get by in the academic world. Here you are, meditating on metis, pondering it, writing about it. You have to use metis. And I knew he was wrong. In a way, he was right, but I knew that from the point of view of metis, he was wrong. And it took me a long time to see why. It's because for the ancient Greeks, metis is not allowed to serve the purposes or interests of the ego. In fact, there's this beautiful story in Homer's Iliad where a charioteer uses metis to trick his competitors in a chariot race, and he wins through metis. But it's a low form of metis, and everybody condemns him, and he doesn't even get the prize. You're not allowed to use metis for your own end. It is something sacred in itself. But as well as this, what I saw last week, really for the first time, and this has been with me for 30 years, the point that I'd missed is metis is not about cunning in the sense of compromise. It's a totally different form of cunning. It's actually when you don't compromise. It's actually when you just face the impossible and you refuse to take the easy route. That is what metis is. It's the impossible and the impossible and the impossible and how to live with that. So I would like in that spirit now to talk a little about the impossible in our situation here. First of all, you know, I'd like to be logical because this tradition of these ancient Greeks, Empedocles, Parmenides, were so important in coming into Sufism, but were so important, I have to say it again, in laying the foundations for Western civilization. These people with metis, with cunning, they used metis. They used this resourcefulness. They used this trickery to create Western civilization. The whole of Western civilization is based on a trick. And if we don't understand that, if we don't honor that, and we try to be too serious, then we'll be tricked. It's not only in the fabric of creation, it's in the fabric of this civilization we live in. And you can see it how, for example, in the law courts, how here or in the UK or wherever, there is so much abuse. You know, if you have the richest, most powerful lawyer on your side, you will win because they know the tricks. And that really is not how it was meant to be. That's a whole other story. But we've forgotten that trickery is an essential part of the legal system. Sounds very paradoxical. We actually think it's supposed to be fair in terms of our concepts of fairness, and therefore it's not fair, and we know it's not. If we were to understand that the legal system was not meant to be fair, it was meant to be a court in which something could appear from another world, and in which metis could be practiced freely without being misused by the ego, then we could actually get somewhere. Then the idea of being a witness, of being a prosecutor, of being on the defense, whatever, this would all make sense in a totally different way. It's a completely different game. It's the same with science. You know, if you look from the point of view of this tradition at anything in this modern world, whether it's media, advertising, the legal system, science, education, it all starts to appear totally, totally different, a completely different light. And a part of metis was the use of logic. Logic was introduced from another world as an example of metis. Precision in thinking and precision in the use of words. Not mystical, foggy ideas or foggy thinking or I don't know how to express this. No, if you have had a mystical realization, you must find the right words because those words have the power to make that realization real. Otherwise, it'll go back into the unconscious and be lost. And so these people actually concretized, they made their mystical experiences real, and that manifested as Western civilization, as the gift that this culture was supposed to be. And the logic is quite simple. The logic is, well, those of us who have had mystical experiences, we know that God is one. That reality is one. Oneness, oneness. So how many people logically are there in this room? Or experientially? How many people are there here? How can there be more than one person here? And if we're not experiencing that fact now, why are we not? There's only one person in this room. And the whole of our lives are just distorting mirrors in which we're seeing ourselves. That is logic, and that is true, and that's something that can be experienced. That's what they mean by the alone to the alone. That's what it means when you pray and the prayer isn't answered and the answer comes through you. There's no duality. We talk about duality, but how can we talk about duality when we admit that there are 100 or 150 people in this room? It's not logical. It's not real. And these people will go further and further. What about this world? And probably we've all had these glimpses of being able to look at trees or hills or the ocean and actually know, I am the creator of everything I see. I am the creator of Japan. I'm the creator of United Airlines. If there is oneness, there is oneness. What is the point of dialoguing about oneness unless there is oneness in the oneness? How long do we have to go on deceiving ourselves, talking about oneness with other people? How can we talk about oneness with other people if there is oneness? How long do we have to go on doing this? And what I love about these people is how precise they were. They would say, there is no duality. There's just oneness. So They say there's no distance, there's no movement, there's no separation. There's nothing wrong with the senses. They're absolutely fine. We use the senses to see oneness. We use movement to find stillness through the movement. Because this here, this room, is reality. This is it. And they would actually say, there's no path, but now, by way of deceiving you, I'll talk about a spiritual path. But they would qualify what they say in that way, just so you wouldn't get too carried away by the illusion. They'd give it, but they'd take it away. This, again, is the subtlety. Don't forget that although I'm going to talk about a path, there is no path. Don't forget that although I'm going to use the word death, there is no death. Don't forget, and of course all the great ones, the great philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Plutarch, Plotinus, blah, blah, they've all forgotten. You know, they can't read these people. That's how everybody in this tradition, this incredibly subtle tradition, got turned upside down and misunderstood because they were being so subtle. They were saying, listen to me, there is no spiritual path. And then they talk about a spiritual path, and everybody would start writing textbooks with a chapter, you know, the spiritual path according to Parmenides or whatever. Empedocles was quite beautiful about this. He'd say at the beginning, when I talk about death, I'm not talking about anything real. There's no such thing. See, people are terrified of death. Humans are terrified of death. They're scared shitless of death. And they call it horrifying, terrifying, all of these horrible words. And he said, it's none of that. Death is just freedom. And he'd say then, but, you know, I have to speak to you in human language, so I'm going to speak about death in human terms. But when I talk about death, don't imagine that I'm talking about something real. And when I use expressions like terrifying death, remember it's not me who's saying that. It's everybody else. And then a few lines further in his poem, he'll talk about terrifying death, and everybody gets freaked out. And they start talking about Empedocles saying how terrifying death is. This is the subtlety. You know, something is said, a warning is given, we ignore the warning, and we make something out of it. It's like I made something out of Empedocles. Now, I'd just like to speak for a little. This is really about basics. You know, it's like us in the room, what is happening here? Words. I'd like to say a little about words. I think a little bit, maybe, if she allows, about silence. If silence permits me to. I find it very interesting that however conscious we get, or however spiritual or whatever, we still don't really stop and look at the basics. And I think it would be wonderful if we can just, for a few minutes, just revise everything and go back to square one. Can we do that? I mean, what is this? You know, you've been sitting here for 1.5 days listening to people speak. And then you go off to lunch and you speak. And then you go to sleep and you're silent, except the neighbors are making a noise properly. But, you know, I mean, it's a very, very strange... Or you ask a question. That's your chance to have your speech because you're really feeling repressed and frustrated when the other person was speaking and you want to have your say. So these words, going, boom, 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 boom. And then we go out into the world and there's the radio and everybody yak, yak on the cell phone and talk, talk, talk. What are words? What are they? What is this strange medium that we use to write with or that we use to talk with? Why don't we talk about that? Is it possible we can look at this whole process of someone sitting on a platform in front of you in a different way and just look at words in a fresh light? Now, we know that words are important. Words hurt. Words can nourish. Words can inspire. But let me just... I have it here. Let me read to you from this tradition something about words. And please, really just try to ponder this, because, you know, as I said to begin with, I'm not quite present, and this tradition is not quite present. And to be honest with you, I'd rather not be involved in this. But I have to do it somewhere. I have no choice to try and make what is not present present. It's impossible. And this is something that is not quite present, and it needs to come back and become present now so that we can move forward into the future. There seems to be an urgency about it too.